Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about New Scientist, 24th of November 2018, Episode 3. Clipping a fair pace through it now. This is in the brief section, so we haven't reached the articles even yet. This one hasn't got an author because it's in brief, but let's listen to it. That espresso habit may be down to your DNA, so it shows different cups of coffees, different things. Are you a tea or coffee person? The answer may be written in your genes. Both drinks contain bitter components such as caffeine. I suppose it's a bitter, is alkaline, isn't it? Previous research has found people's experience of bitter flavours depends according to taste receptors of genes they have. And so bitter is actually not supposed to be a good taste. We've developed it, and we have the bitter receptors separate location at the rear of our tongue to stop swallowing poisons. If food has gone off, it can be bitter. Now, Daniel Huang of the University of Queensland in Australia and his colleagues have studied the link between taste receptor genes and tea and coffee consumption in over 430,000 men and women in the UK aged 37 to 73. Those with gene variants made them taste caffeine more vividly were 20% more likely than the normal caffeine taster to be heavy coffee drinkers. Wow. How you can get that much genetic detail? I don't understand. Caffeine superstars were less likely to drink tea. This may be because people who can detect caffeine more easily are more prone to getting addicted to stimulant effects. Coffee is more caffeine than tea. Oh dear, this is a bit woofly. In contrast, participants with gene variants that made... I'm sure they weren't a participant. That made them more sensitive to two bitter tastes, quinine and propylthiouracil, were 4 to 9% more likely to be heavy tea drinkers, respectively. That sort of rather makes me strange. So quinine is a bitter, and propylthiouracil, I think I sort of can almost imagine that as a amino acid, sorry, a base acid. These people were also less likely to drink coffee. It's unclear why, but it may be because they are more sensitive to bitter tastes overall. As a result, they may prefer gentler bitterness of tea, says Huang. A nearby alien world hiding in near sight. So I think we've got Proxima, Alpha Centauri, Proxima Centauri, Alpha Centauri, Beta Centauri. I wonder where this will be. Okay. A still a neighbour that have been stared at for years appears to have a planet after all. Barnard Star, okay, is a red dwarf just 6 light years away. That makes it the next closest star to the Sun after those in Alpha Centauri system. That's the 3 stars. And an obvious target for planet spotters, but despite many astronomers looking, no planets ever showed up. Ingres Uribes, the Institute of Spain Studies in Catalonia in Spain, and his colleagues may have hit the jackpot. They combined results of earlier surveys looking for the wobbling stars causing a tug in the orbiting object. So small was the effect in the proposed planet GJ. So what GJ stands for? 699b, or on Barnard Star, that they needed 171 readings. I've just been bitten to death here. Taking over 20 years to be sure they'd seen something. Still proposed. GJ699b is thought to have 3 to 4 times the mass of Earth and a surface temperature of minus 150 degrees Celsius. So well, they'll only do that by its orbital distance. Icy grave of huge meteorite discovered. I wonder if that's hit, obviously, in Antarctica. Let's see. I'll have to go through. A giant meteorite crater has been turned up under Greenland's ice sheet and holds clue for the mini ice age that occurred some 13,000 years ago. Ooh, a bit of a dangerous thing to say. The international team found a 30-kilometer-wide feature using NASA's radar data, which would have been made by a meteorite 1 kilometer across. A river draining from underneath the ice covering the crater is washing out sediments from the particles. I think you'd better get onto that. Telltale's internal structure that results from a brief shockwave. So you get certain stressed quartz as a typical shockwave things. They're absolutely characteristic for an impact. So it's called impact quartz. This is team member Ian McDonald at Cardiff University. Sounds a strange statement. A scientist wouldn't say that. Without access to the crater, the team can only date the impact by to the past 3 million years. But that leaves open the possibility of a connection to a short episode of Northern Hemisphere cooling called the Younger Dryas, as McDonald. Yeah, it's interesting to know that the Northern and Southern Hemispheres, atmospheres, aren't really coupled. Its cause has long been unclear. So once in 3 million years, that's, or 30,000 is 1% of 3 million years, isn't it? So, this is less than 0.5% of that age range. If the meteorite had hit the ice hundreds of meters thick, millions of tons of fresh water would have melted and flowed into the sea. This could have disrupted the currents and cooled the climate. Okay, it's a possibility, but it's still a remote one, isn't it? Fungus-based bots to tackle pollution. Bots, okay. Microbots made with mushroom spores could help remove heavy elements from contaminated water. Metal pollutants cling to devices which are spores coated with iron oxide. The external magnetic field can be used to remove the microbots around the water to recover them later. I don't know how they get to say that's a microbot if they don't describe what it does. I think that's a bit of an exaggeration, poor translation possibly. The system was created by Li Zhang, a Chinese university in Hong Kong, and colleagues. They found that microbots could reduce the lead levels in contaminated water from 5 parts per million to 0.09 parts per million within 50 minutes. It's still not safe to drink, but Zhang suggests using the device in less heavily polluted water. Is it just spores coated with iron oxide, or what's the difference from actually just poking in? Oh, so the spores absorb it, and I can pull the spores out by a magnet. In brief, gain. How cities boost a hurricane? There we go. Let's listen to this. The towering skyline of Houston, Texas, made Hurricane Harvey dump even more water because tall buildings shifted the air upward, generating more rain. This and other consequences of urbanization increased the overall flooding risk by a whopping 1,200%, 21 times. My overall question is, you just can't say other effects. You've got to listen. Harvey caused a damage bill of $125 billion last year. Now, using climate models, researchers at the University of Iowa and Princeton University have studied the impact of the hurricane likely Harvey on a virtual version of present-day in Houston, and compared it with what would have happened if the city were replaced by farmland. Oh, God. Vegetation land soaks up lots of rain, yeah, for sure. But if roads, buildings, and pavings replace plants, the rain flows straight into rivers, which can cause increased flooding downstream. In addition, larger surface roughness of urban areas created a drag effect on Hurricane Harvey, says team member Gabriel Villani of Iowa. The result was to push the warm surface air higher up, creating conditions favorable for cloud formation and precipitation. I think clouds are already thoroughly formed for the cyclone. Previous studies have suggested that global warming may have increased Harvey's rainfall total between 15 to 40%. All in all, it seems Harvey was a very unnatural disaster. Oh dear. It must be climate change all the time. Hungry for something new? This edible game may satisfy. Well, this is amazing. You really are the controller now. Players of Guts game must swallow a sensor pill and then fight off an imaginary parasite by making changes to their own gut. Small wearable sensors such as those in Fitbits have already been used to gamma fly exercise. Now Zhu Ying and Lloyd Muller at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology. I think that's an old name, isn't it? RMIT University. Have explored what is possible using ingestible sensors. These capture video, detect chemicals, and measure acidity and temperature or pressure. The guts game is for two players. Both swallow sphincter and must alter their gut's temperature at set times over 24 to 36 hours to kill virtual parasite. To do this, they consume hot, cold items, exercise hard, or eat spicy dishes to make themselves sweat. The game ends once one player excretes the sensor. This will be absolutely fun. Dude, that's stupid. The sensor beams temperature and data phone to the phone app. The winner is the player who does the best at matching the target temperature to the given times. Seven pairs of players tried the game with mixed reactions. Some felt trepidation at taking advice. Others said they had learned about their bodies, especially how food and drink could change temperature. That's actually probably good. Whereas gut temperature is most effective by exercise, researchers presented the game at the Computer Human Interaction Conference in Melbourne. They say there were no risks as the players' temperature changes was small. Muller hopes gamifying pill taking will provide ideas to help people stick to medication. Well, that's rather interesting, isn't it? That is a bizarre article. Painful downside of weekend lie-ins. Sleeping in on days off may cause period pain by disrupting reproductive cycles. Obviously, only in women. We know female shift workers are more prone to irregular menstrual cycles, to difficulties in conceiving, and to miscarriages, probably because their work hours affect the circadian rhythms that control the hormone cycles. We do now that you've told us. Oh, we're getting eaten alive by mosquitoes. Thank goodness they're not malaria mosquitoes. Bloody hell. Okay. Now, Yoko Kimura of Meiji Pharmaceutical University, the Pharmaceutical University in Japan, and her colleagues have looked at whether social jet lag, sleeping in on weekends to make up for early starts in the week, has a similar effect. They surveyed 150 female Japanese university students about sleep habits and their menstrual patterns. The students were deemed to have social jet lag if the midpoint of their sleep was at least an hour off later for days off. Those with social jet lag reported significantly more pain, bloating, behavioural changes during their periods. I think this is just a really flawed study. The greater the social jet lag, the worse the symptoms. Chronobiology, time biology. The team ruled out any impact from late night drinking and or smoking, since few of the students drank and none smoked. How many students? 150. None smoked. There you go. Just hit reverse to remember better. Now, this is interesting because that would show some bias. It'd be interesting to see the sample bias then. Just hit reverse to remember better. To improve your recall, try walking backwards to boost scores in memory tests. That is the finding of Alcevich of the University of Roehampton, UK. And his colleagues, they asked 114 volunteers to watch a video of a human as her bag was stolen. 10 minutes later, they asked some volunteers to walk forwards or backwards 10 meters while a control group just stood in one place. Then all had to answer interesting questions about the video. On average, a backward walking group got 2 more answers correct than the forward walkers, and the non-walkers are small but statistically significant improvement. Of course, you have the chance there to rerun the study with the same walkers doing back and forward. 5 variants of the experiment showed a similar effect, and some participants imagined forwards or walking backward motion, or watched a film shot of a train to give a sense of forward-backward movement. We're used to thinking about time and space to navigate, and to using spatial language to talk about time. Studies of this sort suggest not just a convenient analogy, but an intrinsic way we conceptualise the past. That is sort of very weak science. Oops. So I'm on blood thinners and these mozzies are almost popping off. Okay. Picture of a baby here. It's called Messy Business. Insight about baby disposal nappies. Messy Business. Messy Business. Disposal nappies have been named as the latest plastic items we should ban. But are the alternatives any better? Alice Klein investigates. A fresh stink is being kicked up over the use of nappies. Last month, UK Environment Secretary Michael Gove ignited controversy by hinting a crackdown on disposable nappies. Environmentalists welcomed the idea, but time-poor parents balked at the prospect of having to wash piles of cloth substitutes. Despite feeling soft, the surface layer of disposable nappies is just one of the many plastic components. There are nappies generate 4 million tons of waste each year in the US alone. With each child typically getting through 4,000 to 6,000 of them. So it's no surprise that they've become the latest list of items targeted for environmental reasons. Governments around the world, so they've got sodium polyacrylate beads in them, which is disposable. Governments around the world are already phasing out single-use plastic items such as bags, straws, utensils in an attempt to cut waste. But some parents argue that, when you look at the data, cloth nappies are no better than standard disposal variety. Reusable cloth nappies carry a cost to the environment because of the water and the energy used in repeat laundry. There's also dozens of new eco-disposable products, which their makers claim combine the convenience of disposable nappies with the environmental sustainability. But these come at their own flaws. How do the options stack up? To compare different nappies, researchers conducted life cycle assessments, that is the life cycle not of the nappy, I hope of the child, to consider the environmental impact. Well, it's supposed to be the nappy, you know, just where it comes in the packet and all that sort of stuff. The first of these was commissioned in early 2000 by UK Environmental Agency after Prime Minister Tony Blair was quizzed what kind of nappies he would use on his fourth child. My thing is that you can really cut it down by cutting the boxing nappies and stuff like that. The report, which was published in 2005, sparked fury amongst anti-plastic campaigners. It concluded that reusable cloth nappies were no greener than plastic disposal ones because the electricity consumed by washing and drying them cancelled out the benefits of reducing plastic production and waste, i.e., well, it's different if you hang them up on the line, I expect. I still get email abuse every now and again, says Simon Ambuer of UK consulting firm Environmental Resource Management, who co-wrote the assessment. Let's see, environmental consulting firm who probably wouldn't want to, wonder how he's paid. Critics said the report was misleading because it was based on how most people use nappies rather than the optimal use. I would say that's true. In response, Ormeyer and his colleagues published a follow-up report in 2008. It found that if cloth nappies were washed at full nose, air-dried, a washing line, and reused for a second time, they resulted in a 40% lower greenhouse emission than plastic disposal ones. The benefits are likely to be even greater today now that half the UK's electricity comes from low-carbon sources, says Ottman. Similarly, Kate O'Brien at the University of Queensland in Australia co-authored a study showing that reusable cloth nappies were much greener than the plastic disposables if they were washed in front-loading machines in cold water, although most manufacturers recommend washing at warmer temperatures and line dried. It's pretty clear cloth nappies have less impact overall if you wash them the right way, she says. That may be the case, but it's hard to deny the superior convenience of plastic disposable. Modern cloth nappies are much easier to use than a safety pin terry tiling squares of yesteryear that were I used to do. But they still require time, commitment, and physical space for washing and drying. They can't simply be chucked in the bin when you're out and about. Quote, for stay-at-home parents living in a house, cloth nappies are very feasible options, but they're hard if you work full-time or live in a flat, says O'Brien. Plastic nappies are still used by 95% of parents in the West and make up 4% of municipal household waste. Whoa! 4% nappies. Whoa, that's a lot. Once in landfill, they take hundreds of years to break down, which is an instant. To cut this burden, some councils in
UK and Australia offer cash incentives to encourage parents to switch to cloth nappies. Others are thinking about setting up schemes to turn discarded plastic nappies into new products. This tissue sounds a bit smelly. The baby's first poo, which is meconium, which is this green gunk, is just disgusting. Small nappy recycling initiatives in UK and Netherlands have previously failed because of high running costs. But now bigger players are stepping in. One is Procter & Gamble, which is currently owns the lion's share of the global nappy market. Last year announced it was investing in a European Union scheme aiming to convert 10,000 tonnes of used nappies. So I'm just being eaten alive by ants. Everything's dropping out of the trees at the moment. As incontinence pads per year into plastic bins, packaging and medical devices. It sounds ideal, but Ultimate warns that it may not be the miracle solution everyone's hoping for. The recycling process is likely to be energy intensive and could outweigh the waste reduction benefits. There's an assumption that recycling automatically means better, but as a bit of a skeptic, I'd like to see it demonstrated, he says. Guilt-free. In the meantime, some people are turning to eco-disposable nappies, which are marketed as get-out-of-jail-free cards for busy, environmental-conscious parents. These are also single-use nappies, but they are made of plant-based materials such as cellulose, wood pulp, bamboo, corn or wheat starch. They are meant to be more sustainable and biodegradable than plastic. It's actually a benefit having the person just doing power tools next door, because it means that I concentrate. A clear benefit is that they are made from plants instead of non-renewable petrochemicals. However, their biodegradable comes with a major caveat. Although some eco-disposables are marked, you can hear it's quieter because I've actually gone to the other end of the garden. Although some eco-disposables are marketed as having a flushable insert, most only break down efficiently when composted. If they end up in landfill, the lack of oxygen means even plant-based nappies may take decades to decompose. Yeah, but I mean, it's the decomposition of the entire thing. I really think we should deal with that by actually laying down air pipes in your landfill to make sure air always gets in. This is my view. Moreover, types of bacteria that degrade them under such low oxygen conditions release potent greenhouse gas methane as a byproduct. Yeah, this is why I really think with landfill you should just layer it with air pipes. It's my view. In fact, a life cycle assessment by Nadia Mirabella of University of Milan in Italy found that eco-disposable nappies were no better than plastic ones if they went to landfill. Dig around the problem, some parents use home composting system to use eco-disposable nappies into fertilizer. We hear neat testimonials of people whose gardens are powered by the kids' nappies. This is Jesse Graham Neal, co-founder of the US-based company G Diapers, which sells eco-disposable nappies. Of course, he would hear it. Each nappy takes about 40 days to break down in home compost, he says. But this can only be done for urine-containing nappies due to the risk of spreading fecal pathogens. It's also unlikely to appeal to time-poor parents who don't have a garden. The answer may be to introduce a pick-up service that take households' used nappies away to commercial composters, says Jim. No, is he the same person? He's the same person, yeah. This month, his company started a trial of a childcare centre in Southampton, UK, to test the idea. They deliver compostable nappies to the centre and collect the used ones at regular intervals for composting. All nappies can be composted with this setup, no matter what they are soiled in. It's completely zero waste, said Graham, who hopes to eventually expand the surface to households, although it's not clear how much the surface will cost parents. Surely the compost will be worthwhile. For the time being, however, parents face the unavoidable trade-off between eco-friendliness and convenience. The greenest options appear to be cloth nappies, that are launched with the minimal energy and eco-disposables that are composted at home. Although they require bigger investments of time and effort, plastic disposables make life easier, but only the expense to the environment. Fortunately, governments and companies seem to be increasingly motivated to find solutions. After Grove made his initial comments about needing to tackle plastic nappy waste, he clarified that the UK government would be looking at green alternatives rather than outright ban. If these take the form of eco-friendly recycling and composting schemes for disposable nappies, the babies of today may become guilt-free parents of tomorrow. Isn't that beautiful? Okay, you've come a long way, baby. Old school cloth nappies were squares of cloth terry toweling that had to be folded and safety pinned in place, and really high-powered hoses to get the poo out of them. Although we had nappy liners, this is the interesting thing. We had sort of cotton nappy liners, and so the poo wouldn't get involved in the terry liners. Because they come pre-shaped. Okay, bottle cloth nappies are far easier to use because they come pre-shaped with usually fastened with pressed studs of Velcro. They may often be made of bamboo or hemp, which is more absorbent than cotton, but they are less effective than disposable varieties, which contain super absorbent polymer bead, which would be polyacrylate. Yeah, it's the carbon-carbon acetate group. Some modern nappies have two parts, a waterproof cover, absorbent insert. Only the insert needs to be washed and dried. Cloth nappies are about $20 each, which is 10 times more than plastic disposable. But they need to be, but because they are reused, they end up costing about half the amount of the overall from birth to toilet training. Is that birth to toilet training? Well, of course, non-disposable nappies have a money supply with them, are profitable, and therefore have a fairly fixed thing to market. The easy to advertise stack. There's a whole lot of other variables in it. 23 minutes in, let's read this next article, which is comment. So these comments are always by, they're not always the best. Here, because they're usually a lobbyist or some sort of group. Okay, nuclear power. The Union of Concerned Scientists has warmed to nuclear power. Environmentalists should too, says Mark Lyons. I think there's something only 700 people in the union, and they've got this funny way of reporting statistics. Okay, changing your mind on controversial topic isn't easy, especially when you've spent decades campaigning against your new position, which is why the decision of by the Union of Concerned Scientists, UCS, to drop its long-standing opposition to nuclear power is so important, and why the organisation deserves great credit for having the courage to take the step. Now, okay, I don't like that one. The US advocacy group isn't campaigning for nuclear plants to be built, however. Its president, Ken Kimmel, has called for funding, quote, to preserve nuclear power from existing plants that are operating safely. The rationale laid out in the UCS latest report being that the shuttered nuclear plants are often replaced with ones burning fossil fuels. Ha ha. Oh, the logic really hurts my head to hear. The switch from nuclear to coal has happened most clearly in Germany, where Chancellor Angela Merkel's decision to phase out nuclear power generation has led to increased reliance on fossil fuels. The site of a nation that once led the fight against climate change, bulldozing forests to expand open-cut coal mining, serves as a warning of where anti-nuclear ideology can lead. Oh dear, this is rich. It is important for the UCS in its report, recognises nuclear is the single largest source of low-carbon electricity in the US, yet many US reactors are threatened with closure due to competition from cheap fracked gas and a power market that puts no value on low-carbon electricity. I would definitely say so. Gee, Donald Trump, you've got something to answer for. The UCS estimates that if at-risk nuclear power plants are closed early, as Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth demand, then the US power sector emission will increase 46%. The truth is that nuclear power will be a central component of rapid transition away from fossil fuels. Renewables like wind and solar will hopefully provide the bulk of future global energy. But without nuclear, any low carbon pathway is a dead end. I don't know why they're saying that. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's recent report issued a stark warning. Global emissions must fall by 45% in just 12 years if a reasonable chance to reach 1.5 pathways is to be retained. It would be immensely foolish to begin a colossal effort to decarbonize the world's economy by getting rid of the largest existing source of low-carbon electricity. So I think there's another argument, is that you want to keep nuclear energy going so you don't get pushed into carbon at the very time. Nuclear's problem of waste, cost, and safety are trivial compared to the threat posed by mitigated by global warming. And it is true that coal is more radioactive than nuclear because the coal gas goes in the upper atmosphere and gets hit by cosmic rays. The UCS decisions will be seen as a hugely significant moment in the battle against global warming when environmentalists begin to wake up with the sheer magnitude of global low-cost carbon energy challenge. This is a weird argument. The next step is for all of us to unite to demand a rapid phasing out of fossil fuels and their replacement with low-carbon sources, including nuclear, before it's too late. Mark Linus is an environmentalist and author of Seeds of Science, Why We Got It Wrong on GMOs. Do you know what GMO stands for? Genetically Modified? Don't understand. One Track Mind. The brains of men and women aren't fundamentally different, says Dean Burnett. However, I think there's lots of research shows that it's different. I've read books and books on it. Let's see what they have to say. Last week, a widely reported study claimed very clear differences between the brains of men and women. It was trumpeted in the media as proving that male and female brains are inherently different. The actual evidence falls way short of such claims. Distinctions do exist, genetic differences due to sex chromosomes, varying hormones, regulations during development, and obvious anatomical differences are all reflected in the structure of the brain. But whether these have any impacts on the functioning of a mature adult brain is a little hard to determine. There are just too many other factors and variables that we can affect how we use our brains, which cannot be screened out by modern research methods. And we all grow and develop to a society that imposes countless differences between males and females from birth. Given how our brains grow in response to our environment, they're the most plastic organ in our bodies so far. I think this is a major point. Any of these could turn out to be a big influence on how our brains work as adults. Why is so much energy, which could be better used elsewhere, ploughed into the effort to show the functional difference between the brains of men and women, especially when it's far from certain such thing exists? An optimistic view is that uncovering them could be available to medicine, mental health, and user interfaces, workplaces, and more. But something being useful to us isn't evidence that it should exist. Not evidence is not sufficient. Utility is not. Well, why not? I think most. I don't know, it's a bit hard to actually comprehend. A more cynical view is that there is a strong gender imbalance in our society, with men holding a majority of power and control in almost every field. Studies trying to show the brains of men and women are functionally different, and the inevitable wild coverage in the media often seems like attempts to justify the status quo rather than question it. Our brains develop in a culture that keeps insisting men and women are different, and so we have behave accordingly. And this includes, unfortunately, carrying out reporting researchers' confirmed beliefs. Yeah, it would be nice if you could look at the different brains, say, of dolphins or something like that. Pick something out there that would be really good. Google to control of app used by National Health Service does not sound good to me. Douglas Heaven. Another tech company doing something it said it wouldn't. Another eye rolling, another shrug. Last week, London-based artificial intelligence company DeepMind announced that the team behind Streams, an app designed to monitor people in a hospital with kidney disease, will be joining DeepMind's sister company in Google. Okay, that doesn't sound too scary. The tech giant wants to turn Streams into an AI-powered assistant for doctors and nurses. To test Streams, DeepMind used identify medical records of 1.6 million people obtained in a deal with the Royal Free London NHS Trust, as it revealed, as first revealed to New Scientist. UK's Information Commissioner Office, ICO, later said the data sharing agreement failed to comply with data protection law, as I would expect. The transfer appears to renege on promises made by DeepMind. Co-founder Mustafa Suleiman wrote in July 2016, for example, DeepMind operates autonomously from Google, and we've been clear from the outset that at no stage will the parent data ever be linked to associate with Google accounts, products or services. So, it's no surprise that the announcement has led to a chorus of complaints of social media, with many people feeling particularly strongly about the powerful private firm putting their hands on NHS cookie jar. DeepMind argues that Google will have no access to the identifiable patient's data. True, DeepMind is only handing over synthetic data made up of medical records generated from real NHS ones and algorithms that were trained on. But this valuable information only exists because of identifiable data. One question is whether Google should have its own data sharing agreement with NHS. In its ruling on DeepMind's original idea, ICO concluded that patients have been adequately engaged by giving informed consent. Do they need to give additional consent to Google to profit from the medical records? Dobek Kling, clinical lead at DeepMind's health division, seems to suggest so. Quote, at this stage, our contracts have not moved across to Google and will not without our partner's consent, he wrote on Twitter on the 14th of November. Quote, the same applies to data that we process under these contracts. Yet, the legal issues are murky. DeepMind's contract with the Royal Free says it cannot transfer intellectual property derived from the patient data obtained under the terms of the deal. Exactly how much of Streams counts as data-derived IP can be spun in different ways, however. Quote, our contractual agreement with existing partners and their restrictive rules on patient data are still in force and unchanged, DeepMind spokesman told New Scientist. Google has long had its eye on healthcare, but it had tried to make a deal with the NHS, it would probably have been blocked because of privacy concerns. AI is capable of amazing things, and there is little doubt that eventually the technology will help save lives, but also make companies offering such services vast sums of money. The NHS giving Google a leg up for free is at the very least anti-competitive. Inviting tech giants into the heart of the healthcare system could lead to a loss of control and how care is provided and cost the NHS more in the long run. So we're on page 27, and there's a beautiful picture of an ant. It's set in resin, but it's almost as though you're sitting there. I don't know how they've done it. Okay, the amber spyglass. Some 50 million years ago, that's 40 million years after the death of dinosaurs, an ant was foraging on a tree trunk growing on what is now the Baltic coast of Russia. Which used to be the Baltic coast of Germany, I'm sure. A trickle of resin oozing from the trees trapped the insect, killing it and sealing it off from the world. And yet, here it is. Fossils invoke a sense of wonder because they connect us physically with the distant past. I do say so. When organisms are trapped in tree resins and fossilize it, as it turns to amber, this dehydrates the body and drastically slows decomposition, forming beautifully preserved specimens, but the captured organisms Literal time capsules have never been so clearly seen as the new images by the photographer Levon Biss. I say it is such a clear thing. You can almost see the hairs. You can't see the hairs quite. No, yeah, you can. I am wrong. I just look at here, and I can actually see hairs on this fossil. Wow, you can see that. And previously, Biss specialised in photographing insects with a microscope by stitching together thousands of close-up to create an ultra-high resolution images. Looking for another challenge, he now turns his attention to insects trapped in amber. And the first finished print is this ant from an unknown species, and that's unfortunate. These fossil subjects are smaller than those Biss usually photographs, and are in material that makes camera work more difficult. Quote, to overcome the effects of refraction from the amber, the stone is suspended in an oil of similar refractive index, he says. This allows me to produce images of high clarity. Creating unique and beautiful imagery should not be easy. If it was, the final photography would make it worthless to me. The images are printed in a process called carbon transfer, which should stop the colours fading for 1,000 years. They are framed in wood from trees preserved in peat bogs of carbon dated to 5,300 years ago. So 50 million years, that's a thousandth of its age. The piece of amber is presented in the cavity of the frame, provide the viewer with a sense of scale. So you've got the big picture and then the actual piece of amber. So that's a quite good idea. I adore the fact that this project essentially began millions of years ago when these little creatures were encapsulated within the tree's sap, Biss says. I began a long time before me, and because of the longevity of the princess process, it will continue a long time in the future. That is a point. Every picture is going to fade, but what about the digital world? I suppose he's an artist. You deconstructed. There are 37 trillion cells, and there's 10 to the 23, 602 billion trillion cells. In Avogadro's number, it's 603 billion trillion. It's 602 billion trillion. 602 is 6 by 10 to 2. 9 and 12 is 21. Yeah, that's right. 10 to 23. 602 billion trillion. Okay, you deconstructed. There's all these cells. Now we're finally working out what they all do, says Jeremy Webb. That sounds a bit weird to me. Let's see what this article has to say. It's interesting that you have a massive colony of individual cells. It's one of biology's dirty little secrets. We don't really know what we're made of. The human genome may have decoded back in 2003, but we still can't list all the types of cells in our body. Everything we do, from moving to thinking, digesting food to sleeping, depends on a vast array of different cells. Disc-like red blood cells, spindly nerve cells, stretched-out cells that make your muscles, and the list goes on. These specialized units come together to form tissues and organs and make us the complex organism we are. And yet, so many of them remain mysteriously. Now, for the first time, we are set to make a comprehensive inventory. The aim is every bit as ambitious as the Human Genome Project, that decoded our DNA. Human Cell Atlas project plans to identify and locate every type of cell we possess, and so to revolutionize our understanding of the body in the same way the first atlases transformed our view of the world. Isn't that great? Beautiful writing, I suppose. The first results are already showing how this can help us find our way around healthy bodies. Not to mention finding routes to treatments for conditions like cancer that occur when cells turn bad. So cancer cells are quite interesting about metastasis and how they seek out blood supplies. Earlier, quote, knowing cells is knowing life, says Viv Regev of the Bald Institute at Cambridge, Massachusetts. Quote, if you do not know which cells are there and understand how they operate, then you can't really say you understand biology. Or hit this for you, mate. Easier said than done. For more than 150 years, researchers have familiarized cells by all manners of methods, size, shape, their location in the body, their rate, dyes, most recently by the proteins they produce. Look at it in the textbook today, and it's probably divide the body's 37 trillion cells into about 300 types. But each time a novel way to look at the cell has come along, more differences have emerged, and a number of distinct types has continued to rise. The human cell atlas will use even more powerful way to classify cells by the genes that are switched on inside the genes, the transcriptome. So these are the methyl epigenetic markers, the tags, I forgot what they're called, that produce it. It's very, what's they called? Methylation of genes. Barring a few exceptions, all our cells contain identical cables of genetic code. So it would be red blood cells are removed and sperm cells would be things. Each cell controls 20,000 genes it expresses. And different types of cells express different sections of the gene. Knowing which genes are active and the levels go beyond the promise of the Human Genome Project. This allowed us to compare people's genome and understand better than ever which genetic changes are involved. Might be able to survive reading this. Various diseases, but exploiting that knowledge means first knowing which cells these changes are expressed in. To do this, biologists need to be able to read the gene expression profiles of individual cells. Until recently, that process needed a fairly sized chunk of tissue that inevitably contained many different types of cells. These cells then got mushed together into what Regev describes as a fruity smoothie. Beautiful. I'm sure I can see two cell styles. Oh, no. That's interesting. Okay. What's really needed instead, she says, was a fruit salad in which every individual piece of the fruit could be identified. That's rather nice, isn't it? Unknown fruit. So it's a beautiful fruit analogy. In 2011, that became a real prospect when Regev and her colleagues managed to create a gene expression profiles from tiny amounts of genetic materials of a single cell. They used a method on apparently identical immune system cells called dendrite cells. So dendrites are these hair cells, and immediately picked up differences between them that signaled the unknown fruits in a salad. We found two new subjects of cells we didn't know existed before, says Worker. Since then, there's been a revolution in transcriptomics, and new and faster techniques emerging. Most rely on separating out individual cells in a sample and adding a unique barcode in the form of DNA tag to one genome's genetic material. Wow, that's incredible. So you pull out a cell and put a genetic tag on it. Isn't that incredible? The tags allow the output of individual cells to be traced, even when many cells are mixed together for sequencing. There has been an explosion, too, in the number of cells that can be profiled at once, from just 18 to approximately a whopping 250 million. Since single cells methods are really transformational, said Edlin and Allen Institute at Seattle, who specialize in mapping brain cells. You can input a large number of cells from a tissue and get a molecular classification of the cell types in the way that supersedes 100 years of prior research. That is absolutely spectacularly incredible. While Regev was busy at Cambridge, Massachusetts, Sarah Chisholm on the Wellcome Sanger Institute in Cambridge, UK, had also been seen the potential profile and gene expression of sickle cells. Quote, "It would really love to see the periodic table of our cells." Isn't that beautiful? I don't know. She says, in 2003, she developed and found helped found a center in the Serum Institute develop the field. The obvious question in a place like this is, how big can we take it? Can we scale it to the whole organism? In 2014, Rigoff started to think about a systematic approach to sequence all cells in the body. She began to evangelize about the idea in talks and seminars. In 2016, two researchers spoke. They decided to gather specialists from a range of fields, medics, pathologists, cells, computational biologists, genomic technology developers, and big data analysts to gauge their interest. 100. That's pretty good. I love that. That's really nice to see them doing that. 100 people came to the resulting meeting, and they were enthused about the proposal. The idea of the human cell atlas of Berlin, participant and Rickard at the helm. There was a zeitgeist thing. It was an idea whose time had come. Over 1,000 scientists are now involved in the project, representing 184 institutes. So that's one institute from 55 countries, including Ecuador, Kenya, Nigeria, and Russia. Atlases of the cell, of the immune system, skin, and lungs are already underway. The efforts faces many technical challenges: single cell, big data, and certainly still surrounds a second pillar of the project, that is locating the cell in the body. Rickard's analogy of structures being like a fruit salad isn't entirely accurate. Biology is beautifully structured. It's actually a fruit tart, she says. It's not everything is together, or we would look kind of messy. So to really understand how our bodies work, we need to be able to pinpoint individual cells within tissues. For the past 5 years, I can imagine fluorescent data. I can see some fluorescent cells up there. Cells slice in a slice of tissue can be flooded with fluorescent probes that latch onto specific gene sequences here. Or the detail of each cell location can be encoded into a genetic material using DNA tags where tissue is broken up for profiling. In June, researchers at Stanford University in California described a technique for sequencing single cells embedded into 3D tissue samples. So I wonder what the technique is. But these methods cannot cope with the sheer numbers of cells and genes in the human cell atlas needs to analyze. Instead, some samples, which come from a range of sources, from operating theaters to tissue banks, will be stored and examined later once technology catches up. Eventually, the atlas will bring together the data from many labs relating to one organ or point within it. This will enable researchers to run analysis that encompasses all the latest information. That is where the real power lies, says Len. Despite it being early days, the project is making groundbreaking discoveries. Single-cell profiling is already used to investigate the earliest stages of pregnancy, as the fetal placenta implants into the mother's uterus. It's revealed the location of fetal and maternal cells across the interface, and the protein signals are used to communicate. These findings should shed new light on causes of miscarriage and disorders such as preeclampsia, which you covered earlier. Tickman has also been working with Sam Bitch at Sanger's Institute and others on gene expression profiles of kidney cells. In August, they published research showing that cells of Wilms-Schuer, the most common childhood kidney cancer, resemble cells that haven't matured properly. Today, Wilms is treated by toxic chemotherapy. Bajet suggests a better alternative would be to give the cancer cells the correct protein signals to nudge them to becoming mature kidney cells. This could lead to an entirely new model of treating childhood cancer, he says. Perhaps the most surprising of all, in August, two teams discovered a previously unknown cell type, utilizing the lung, that may well be the root of cystic fibrosis. This was the most common single gene disorder in people of Northern Europe descent, and develops when the body doesn't make enough protein called CFTR. The deficit causes sticky mucus to build up in the lungs, repeated infections, and early death. For 30 years, we thought, see, FTR was made of the lungs mostly by ciliated cells. Existing drugs and gene therapies for cystic fibrosis were designed assuming this to be true. Yet new research shows that the lion's share of CFTR is made from newly discovered cells, now named iconocytes. These findings suggest a way to boost the number of iconocytes, which should help some people with cystic fibrosis. Improved treatment for cystic fibrosis and Wilms tumor, a better understanding of why pregnancies fail, are significant steps in their own right. But this is to miss the broader value of the human cell apparatus, Atlas reckons Sten Lisan and Karolinska Institute in Sweden, one of the project's organizing committee. The Atlas is not enabling one specific thing, he says. It's the foundation for exploring human biology. Okay, we're going to read very quickly some by things. What is a cell anyway? Cells don't exactly broadcast their importance. They're almost invisible to naked eye, yet without them we'd have no life. It was the English scientist Robert Hooke, looking at slices of cork through the homemade microscope in 1660s, who first saw cells and named them. It took another 200 years, it looked like cells, prison cells, what he looked at. It took another 200 years for scientists to realize their true significance. The cell is the most basic unit of life, all living organisms are made up of one or more of them. What is the cell theory? It's the basic unit of life. They can make copies of themselves or some other things. Our cells contain an astonishing array of tiny structures such as nucleus, which is home to the genome, mitochondria, responsible for generating energy, endoplasmic reticulum, which proteins and fats are made. I wonder how fats are made. Something I didn't know. All this paraphernalia is surrounded by the cell membrane, which acts as a natural border, allowing only certain communities to run in. I think your tubular structure, your cellular skeleton is a very important thing to mention here. Human cells are nothing if not diverse. Among the smallest is the 50 micrometer sperm. Compare that with an egg, which is a diameter of 1 millimeter or 1,000 micrometers. It's just visible to the human eye. Well, a millimeter thing is pretty visible. I think it's 50 micron is not visible. A nerve cell that runs from the lower spinal cord to the big toe can reach more than 1 meter's length. There are similar diversity roles. Nerve cells receive, process, and transmit information through electrical and chemical channels. Hairs in the ear turn vibrations to impulses we perceive sound. Natural killer cells carry deadly chemicals inside them, with which they eliminate infected and cancerous cells. This is to name but a few. Each type depends on others to sustain them. Nearly all cells, for example, depend on red blood cells to bring oxygen. Obviously, this is your eye, this oxygen transport, and in your brain. So the blood does not reach your actual neurons. It's actually through your astrocytes, which absorb nutrients and put them through it. New types emerge in the embryo, where cells of various regions are exposed to different cocktails of proteins, driving them to express a particular combination of genes and hence develop different cell types. The number of active genes vary even in mature cells. If you have a rapidly proliferating cell, you're talking about 5,000 to 6,000 genes, says Sarah Tishman of the Wellcome Strangler Institute. But if you have a quiescent cell, just mind its own business and not doing much, you can be talking about a couple of thousand genes. Cells can also change their outputs in reaction to signals from their surroundings, which is a fundamental thing of their lock and key DNA. Teasing apart these signals and reactions is a key aim of the human cell Atlas researchers. The thing is, a cell, big single cell, big data. When it comes to profiling genes within a cell, the numbers are mind-boggling. Different cell types express different genes, and to quantify the activity could mean 20,000 scores per cell. The human cell atlas project expected to profile billions of cells. Making sense of the data is a scale is going to need methods that don't yet exist. Oh wow, a core. The project is receiving funding from Charles Zuckerberg Initiative, and set up by Facebook owner Mark Zuckerberg and his wife Priscilla Chan. The money will go towards creating a software tool or platform where researchers can upload the result and analyze the data. The project released its first tranche of data from more than half a million cells in April. One technique popular with the project's biologists is the data visualization tool called TSNE, pronounced TSNE, which groups the cells according to similarities between the thousands of genes' expression scores. It then displays it in two dimensions. This tool plays a crucial role in the discovery of a new kind of lung cell. When all the different cell types from the lining of the lung were plotted with, using TSC, the graph showed a blob distinct from all the other cells. These cells led researchers to a previously unknown cell type, which is called the eicosanoid, that has now been implicated in cystic fibrosis.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.